objects that authorities will later find are a broken comb, tobacco, embroidered slippers, and one very telling scrap of paper. On it are written the keys to top-secret coded Confederate messages that link him with Jefferson Davis's office in Richmond and with the $1 million gold fund in Montreal. Finally, Booth leaves behind damning evidence that implicates John Surratt and, by extension, his mother, Mary. Booth could have destroyed these items, but such is his malevolence that if he is ever apprehended or killed, he wants everyone else to go down as well. He also wants to show the world that he, Booth, was the mastermind behind killing Abraham Lincoln. He walks downstairs and slides his key across the front desk. "Are you going to Forge tonight?" he asks George Bunker, the clerk on duty. "No," comes the reply. "You ought to go," Booth says with a wink, on his way out the door. "There is going to be some splendid acting." Booth laughs at his own joke as he steps into the night air. Washington is covered in a fine mist, giving the streetlights and the Capitol Dome a ghostly appearance. Booth feels like he's viewing the city through frosted glass. He trots his horse over to Ford's. Once again, he examines his escape route, then slides down from the saddle and ties the mare to a hitching post. He steps into a nearby tavern, where he runs into Ford's orchestra director, William Withers, Jr., who's having a last quick drink before the 8 p.m. curtain. They talk shop, the conversation veering toward mutual friends in the theater. Withers mentions Booth's late father. When Booth suggests that he is the better actor of the two, Withers laughingly shoots back that Booth will never be as talented as his father. Booth's face hardens, but he manages a thin smile. Focusing his gaze on Withers, he utters the truest sentence he will ever speak. "When I leave the stage, I will be the most talked about man in America." Chapter 36, Friday, April 14, 1865, 8:05 p.m. "Would you have us be late?" Mary Lincoln chides her husband, standing in his office doorway. Speaker of the House Schuyler Colfax dropped by a half hour ago and was immediately granted a few minutes of Lincoln's time. But those minutes have stretched into half an hour, and across town the curtain has already risen on our American cousin. Making matters worse, the Lincolns still have to stop and pick up their theater guests. They'll be lucky to arrive at Ford's in time for the second act. It is 5 minutes after 8. Mary wears a gray dress that shows her ample bosom and a matching bonnet. She is eager to get to the theater, but tentative in her approach because Mr. Lincoln's moods have been so unpredictable lately. Once again, he has lost all track of time. Speaker Colfax stopped in to discuss the possibility of a special session of Congress. Colfax's plans to leave in the morning on a long trip to California, but says he will cancel if Lincoln calls a special session. Lincoln won't hear of it. He tells Colfax to enjoy himself and to enlist the support of the Western states in reuniting America. As he makes to leave, Colfax pauses at the door. He is a true admirer of Lincoln's. Colfax has heard rumors of violence against Lincoln and mentions how afraid he was when Lincoln visited Richmond a week earlier. "Why, if anyone else had been president and gone to Richmond, I would have been alarmed too," Lincoln chuckles. "But I was not scared about myself a bit." Lincoln asks Colfax if he has plans for the evening, and if not, would he be interested in attending our American cousin. Colfax replies that although he is deeply honored by the invitation, he cannot go. This marks a half dozen rejections for Lincoln today. First the Grants, then Stanton and Thomas Eckert, then his son Robert just a half hour earlier, and now the Speaker of the House. Former Massachusetts Congressman George Ashbaum waits to see Lincoln as Colfax exits. But Mary's pleas finally have an effect. It's time to leave for the theater. Lincoln hastily pulls a card from his jacket pocket, jots a small note inviting Ashbaum to return at 9 in the morning. Finally, Lincoln walks downstairs and out onto the front porch, where the presidential carriage awaits. The roof is now closed, which is a comfort on this misty night. Footman Charles Forbes helps Mary up the steps and into her seat as Lincoln says a few final words to Ashman and Colfax, who have followed him outside. Suddenly, yet another caller steps out of the night, seeking a few moments of Lincoln's time. The president hears the footsteps on the gravel and the familiar voice of former Illinois Congressman Isaac Arnold yelling his name. Lincoln is about to climb into the carriage, but waits until Arnold is close enough so that they can shake hands. Arnold was a staunch backer of Lincoln's during the war's darkest hours, and the resulting dip in the president's popularity cost him his seat in the House. The least Lincoln can do is acknowledge him. He bends his head to listen as Arnold whispers a quiet petition in his ear. Lincoln nods but refuses to give an immediate answer. "Excuse me now," he begs. "I am going to the theater. Come see me in the morning." The Harris residence at H and 15th Streets is almost right across the street from the White House, so the Lincolns have little time alone before picking up their guests. But in that short interval, Lincoln turns lighthearted and happy, chatting excitedly about the night. Mary is delighted at her husband's sudden jocularity and his ability to seemingly leave the burdens of the White House behind the instant they leave the grounds. As the carriage threads the seven blocks to the theater, Rathbone, with his mutton chops and broad mustache, sits facing Lincoln, talking about his experiences in the war. Along the way, another impromptu victory parade on Pennsylvania Avenue slows their progress and makes them even later for the show. Once they finally approach Ford's, they can smell and see the tar torches casting their ghostly yellow shadow in front of the theater. The carriages of theatergoers line 10th Street. A crowd of soldiers gathers there to see Lincoln and Grant. A barker calls out, "This way to Ford's." Driver Francis Burns steps down and walks the horses the final few feet to the theater, fearful that the commotion might cause them to bolt. The two cavalry escorts, trailing the carriage, wheel their horses back to their barracks, knowing that they will return and finish their guard duty once the show ends. It is 8:25 when Lincoln steps through the front door of the theater. A young boy, in a moment he will remember for the rest of his life, shyly offers him a program. The president accepts it with a smile. Now rejoined by bodyguard John Parker, the Lincolns and their guests climb the stairs leading to their box. On stage, the actors are more than aware that the audience is in a foul mood. Having bought tickets in hopes of seeing Lincoln and Grant, the theatergoers had monitored the state box, only to find that neither was in the house. So when Lincoln finally arrives, there is relief on stage. Laura Keene ad-libs a line that refers to Lincoln, making the audience turn toward the back of the theater in order to witness his appearance. William Withers, the orchestra director who had a drink with John Wilkes Booth less than an hour ago, immediately stops the show's music and instructs the band to perform Hail to the Chief. The audience members rise to their feet and cheer, making a noise that Withers can only describe as breathtaking. Lincoln does not seek out such adulation. Indeed, he has an almost morbid dread of causing a scene. But he works the crowd for full effect, allowing Rathbone and Harris to enter the state box first, followed by Mary. Then Lincoln strides forth so the crowd can see him. As patriotic cheering fills the house, he honors his constituents by standing at the edge of the box and bowing twice. Only when the applause dies down does Lincoln ease into the rocking chair on the left side of the box. A curtain partially shields him from the audience, giving him privacy should he decide to nod off and take a nap. The crowd can see Lincoln only if he leans forward and pokes his head over the ledge. Otherwise, he's entirely invisible to everyone in the theater except for those in the state box and the actors on stage. Lincoln takes advantage of the privacy, reaching out for Mary's hand and holding it lovingly. She blushes at such scandalous behavior. "What will Miss Harris make of my hanging on to you so?" she giggles to her husband. "She will think nothing about it," he replies, squeezing her hand but not letting go. Behind Lincoln, a single door leads into the state box. On the other side of the door is a narrow, unlit hallway. At the end of the hallway is yet another door. This is the only route to and from the state box, and it is John Parker's job to pull up a chair and sit in front of this door, making sure no one goes in or out. But on the night of April 14, 1865, as Abraham Lincoln relaxes in his rocking chair and laughs out loud for the first time in months, John Parker gets thirsty. He is bored. And he can't see the play. Taltaville's saloon calls to him. Pushing his chair against the wall, he leaves the door to the state box unguarded and wanders outside. Footman Charles Forbes is taking a nap in the driver's seat of Lincoln's carriage, oblivious to the fog and drizzle. "How about a little ale?" Parker asks, knowing that Forbes will be an eager drinking buddy. The two walk into the tavern and make themselves comfortable. The show won't be over for two more hours, plenty of time to have a couple of beers and appear perfectly sober when the Lincolns need them again. President Abraham Lincoln's only bodyguard, a man with a career-long history of inappropriate and negligent behavior, has left his post for the last time. Incredibly, he will never be punished for his gross dereliction of duty. Chapter 37, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 8:45 p.m. Less than 2 hours to go. John Wilkes Booth summarizes the final details with his co-conspirators as the Lincolns settle into their seats. Though Lewis Powell checked out of his hotel room hours earlier, the four men meet outside the Herndon House because of its close proximity to Ford's. With the exception of Atzerodt, each man is on horseback. Though he has been drinking steadily on and off all day, Booth is thinking and acting clearly. None of the co-conspirators has any cause to doubt him. First and foremost, Booth tells them the precise time of the president's assassination will be 10:15 p.m. Unlike the night before, when the assassination plans had a haphazard quality, tonight's events are timed to the minute. Shows at Ford's usually start promptly. If that's the case, then Harry Hawke will be alone on stage delivering his punchline at precisely 10:15. Second, Booth tells them, the murders of Seward and Johnson must also take place at 10:15. The precision is vital. There can be no advance warning or alarm to the intended targets. The attacks must be a complete surprise. Booth hopes to create the illusion that Washington is a hotbed of assassins, resulting in the sort of mass chaos that will make it easier for him and his men to escape. With officials looking everywhere for the killers, on streets filled with bonfires and spontaneous parades and hordes of drunken revelers, blending into the bedlam should be as simple as staying calm. Next comes the list of assignments. The job of murdering Secretary of State Seward will be a two-man affair, with Lewis Powell and David Herold now working together. Powell will be the man who actually walks up to the door, finds a way to enter the house, and commits the crime. The ruse that will get him in the door is a fake bottle of medicine, which Powell will claim was sent by Seward's physician. Harold's role is to assist in the getaway. He knows Washington's back alleys and shortcuts and will guide Powell, who knows little about the city, to safety. During the murder, Harold must wait outside and hold their horses. Once Powell exits the house, the two men will gallop across town by roundabout method in order to confuse anyone trying to give chase. Then they will leave town via the Navy Yard Bridge and rendezvous in the Maryland countryside. As for George Atzerodt, he will act alone. Killing Vice President Andrew Johnson does not look to be a difficult task. Though Johnson is a vigorous man, he is known to be unguarded and alone most of the time. Atzerodt is to knock on the door of his hotel room and shoot him when he answers. Atzerodt will also escape Washington via the Navy Yard Bridge, then gallop into Maryland to meet up with the others. From there, Atzerodt's familiarity with smugglers' trails will allow him to guide the men into the Deep South. Once the plans are finalized, Booth will head for Ford's. There he will bide his time, making sure the theater's entries and exits are unguarded, that the secret backstage passageways are clear, and that his horse is ready and waiting. Booth clears his throat just before they ride off in their different directions. He tells them about the letter he wrote to the National Intelligencer, implicating all of them in this grand triple assassination. The message is clear. There's no going back. If the men object to Booth outing them, there is no historical record to show it. Booth looks over his gang. These four unlikely men are about to change the course of history. Just as surely as Grant or Lincoln or Lee or any of the hundreds of thousands of men who died during the Civil War. They are now 90 minutes away from becoming the most wanted men in all of the world. He wishes them good luck, then spurs his horse and trots off to Ford's. Chapter 38, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 9:30 p.m. John Wilkes Booth guides his mare into the alley behind Ford's. The night is quiet, save for the peals of laughter coming from inside the theater. He dismounts and shouts for Ned Spangler to come hold his horse. The scene shifter appears at the back door, visibly distressed about the possibility of missing an all-important stage cue. Booth doesn't care. He demands that Spangler come outside and secure the animal. The last thing Booth needs is for his escape to be thwarted by a runaway mare. Spangler, completely unaware of the assassination plot, insists that he can't do the job. Booth, ever persuasive, insists. The unshaven, heavy-lidded stagehand weakens, but does not capitulate. His employment is contingent upon moving the right scenes at the right time. He is willing to do anything for a great actor such as Booth, anything but lose his job. Leaving Booth in the alley, Spangler dashes back into the theater and returns with Joseph Burroughs, a young boy who does odd jobs at Ford's and goes by the nickname Peanut John. Booth hands Peanut John the reins and demands that he remain at the back door, holding the horse until he returns. The boy must not leave that spot for any reason. Peanut John, hoping that Booth will give him a little something for the effort, agrees. He sits on the stone step and shivers in the damp night air, his fists clenched tightly around those reins. Booth slides into the theater. The sound of the onstage actors speaking their lines fills the darkened backstage area. He speaks in a hush as he removes his riding gloves, making a show of saying hello to the cast and crew, most of whom he knows well. His eyes scrutinize the layout, memorizing the location of every stagehand and prop, not wanting anything to get in the way of his exit. There is a tunnel beneath the stage, crossing from one side to the other. Booth checks to make sure that nothing clutters the passage. Nobody guesses for an instant that Booth is checking out escape routes. When he reaches the far side, Booth exits Ford's through yet another backstage door. This one leads to an alley which funnels down onto 10th Street. There's no one there. In one short dash through Ford's Theater, Booth has learned that his escape route is not blocked, that nobody is loitering in the alley who could potentially tackle him or otherwise stop him from getting away, and that the cast and crew think it's the most normal thing in the world for him to stroll into and out of the theater. And indeed, no one questions why he's there, nor finds it even remotely suspicious. Feeling very pleased with himself, Booth pops into Tal Tavol's for a whiskey. He orders the whole bottle, then sits down at the bar. Incredibly, Lincoln's bodyguard is sipping a large tankard of ale just a few feet away. Booth smiles as he pours the water into his whiskey, then raises the glass in a toast to himself. What am I about to do? Can I really go through with this? He pushes the doubts from his head. We're at war. This is not murder. You will become immortal. At 10 p.m., Booth double-checks to make sure John Parker is still drinking at the other end of the bar. Then, leaving the nearly full whiskey bottle on the bar, he softly lowers his glass and walks back to Ford's. Chapter 39, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 10 p.m. The third act is underway. Soon the play will be over and Lincoln could get back to the White House. Meantime, the unheated state box has gotten chilly. Abraham Lincoln drops Mary's hand as he rises to put on his overcoat, tailored in a black wool specially for his outsized frame by Brooks Brothers. The silk lining is decorated with an eagle clutching a banner in its beak. The words on the streamer are Lincoln's unspoken manifesto, and every time he slips on the coat, he's reminded of his mission. One country, one destiny, it reads quite simply. Sitting back down in the horsehair rocker, Lincoln shifts his gaze from the performers directly below him. He pushes back the privacy curtain, then leans forward over the railing to look down to the left at the audience. Lincoln lets go of the curtain and then returns his attention to our American cousin. It is 7 minutes after 10. At the exact same moment, John Wilkes Booth strolls through the front door of Ford's, heart racing, whiskey on his breath, skin clammy to the touch. He is desperately trying to appear calm and cool. Always a man of manners, Booth takes off his hat and holds it with one hand. When ticket taker John Buckingham makes a joke of letting him in for free, courtesy of the house, Booth notices the bulge in Buckingham's lip and asks if he has any extra tobacco. Like so many other minor theater employees, Buckingham is in awe of Booth's celebrity. Not only does he hand over a small plug of tobacco, he also summons the courage to ask if he might introduce Booth to some close friends who happen to be at the show. Later, Booth promises with a wink. Buckingham notes the deathly pallor on Booth's face and how incredibly nervous the normally nonchalant actor seems to be. As Booth walks off, Buckingham's fellow Ford's employee, John Sesford, points out that Booth has been in and out of the theater all day. Wonder what he's up to, Sesford mutters to Buckingham. They watch as Booth climbs the staircase to the dress circle, which accesses the hallway to the state box. But neither man thinks Booth's unusual behavior merits closer scrutiny. They watch him disappear up the stairs, and then once again return their attention to the front door and to the patrons late in returning from intermission. At the top of the stairs, Booth enters the dress circle lobby. He is now inside the darkened theater, standing directly behind the seats of the second-level audience. He hums softly to himself to calm his nerves. In hopes of increasing the theater's capacity for this special performance, Ford's management has placed extra chairs in this corridor, and now Booth walks past two union officers sitting in those seats. They recognize the famous actor and then turn their focus back to the play. They make no move to stop him, because they have no reason to. Booth approaches the door leading into the state box. It is attended by a White House messenger, but not a pistol-packing bodyguard. He sees the chair where John Parker should be sitting and breathes a sigh of relief that the bodyguard is still in the saloon. Handing the messenger one of his calling cards, Booth steps through the doorway without question. In the theater below, a young girl who came to the theater hoping to see Lincoln has spent the night staring up at the state box waiting for him to show his face. Now she is awed by the sight of John Wilkes Booth, the famous and dashing actor, standing in the shadows above her. At the same time, her heart leaps as Lincoln moves his gaze from the stage to the audience, once again poking his head over the railing. Finally, with the play almost over, she has seen the president. She turns to the man next to her, Taltival's owner, Jim Ferguson, and grins at her good fortune. She turns to get another glimpse of Booth, but by then he has already pushed through the door and now stands in the darkened hallway leading into the state box. He is completely alone. If he wants, he can go back out the door and get on with his life as if nothing has happened. The letter boasting of his deed has not yet been sent. Other than the other members of the conspiracy, no one will be the wiser. But if he walks forward down the hallway, then through the rear door of Lincoln's box, his life will change forever. Booth has a head full of whiskey and a heart full of hate. He thinks of the Confederate cause and Lincoln's promise to give slaves the vote. And then Booth remembers that no one can put a stop to it but him. He is the man who can and will make a difference. There will be no going back. Earlier that day, Booth spied a wooden music stand in the state box. He now jams it into the side of the door leading to the corridor. The music stand has become a deadbolt, and Booth double-checks to make sure that it is lodged firmly against the wooden door frame. This seals the door shut from the inside. When he is done, the door might as well be locked. So perfect is his blockade. It's impossible to push open from the other side. No one in the theater can get in to stop him. Booth then creeps down the hallway. Booth's second act of preparation that afternoon was using a penknife to carve a very small peephole in the back wall of the state box. Now he looks through that hole to get a better view of the president. As Booth already knows, the state box is shaped like a parallelogram. The walls to the left and the right slant inward. Booth sees that Clara Harris and Major Rathbone sit along the wall to his far right at an angle to the stage, and the Lincolns sit along the railing. The Lincolns look out directly onto the stage, while Clara and her beau must turn their heads slightly to the right to see the show. If they look directly forward, they will be gazing at Marion Abraham Lincoln in profile. But it is not their view of Lincoln that matters. What matters is that Booth, through the peephole, is staring right at the back of Lincoln's head. He can hear the players down below, knowing that in a few short lines, Harry Hawke's character, Asa Trenchard, will be alone, delivering his sock-dologizing old man-trap line. That line is Booth's cue, and it's just 10 seconds away. Booth presses his black hat back down on his head, then removes the loaded derringer from his coat pocket and grasps it in his right fist. With his left hand, he slides the long, razor-sharp Bowie knife from its sheath. Booth takes a deep breath and softly pushes the door open with his knife hand. The box is dimly lit from the footlights down below. He can see only faces. No one knows he's there. He presses his body against the wall, careful to stay in the shadows while awaiting his cue. Abraham Lincoln's head pokes over the top of his rocking chair, just 4 short feet in front of Booth. Then once again, Lincoln looks down and to the left at the audience. "You sock-dologizing old man-trap!" booms out through the theater. The audience explodes in laughter. Chapter 40, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 10:15 p.m. A few blocks away, someone knocks hard on the front door of the old clubhouse, the home of Secretary of State William Seward. The 3-story brick house facing Lafayette Park, across the street from the White House, took that name from its day as the headquarters of the elite Washington Club. Tragedy paid a visit to the building in 1859, when a congressman shot his mistress's husband on a nearby lawn. The husband, Philip Barton Key, was a United States attorney and the son of Francis Scott Key, who wrote the Star Spangled Banner. Key's body was carried inside the club, where he passed away in a first-floor parlor. That tragedy, however, will pale in comparison with what will happen in the next 10 minutes. There is another sharp knock, even though it's only been a few seconds since the first one. This time the pounding is more insistent. Secretary Seward does not hear it, for he is sleeping upstairs, his medication causing him to drift between consciousness and unconsciousness. William Bell, a young black servant in a pressed white coat, hurries to the entryway. "Yes, sir," he asks, opening the door and seeing an unfamiliar face. A handsome young man with long, thick hair stares back from the porch. He wears an expensive slouch hat and stands a couple of inches over 6 feet. His jaw is awry to the left, as if it was badly broken and then healed improperly. "I have medicine from Dr. Verdi," he says in an Alabama drawl, holding up a small vial. "Yes, sir, I'll take it to him," Bell says, reaching for the bottle. "It has to be delivered personally." Bell looks at him curiously. Secretary Seward's physician had visited just an hour ago. Before leaving, he'd administered a sedative and insisted that there be no more visitors tonight. "Sir, I can't let you go upstairs. I have strict orders." "You're talking to a white man, boy. This medicine is for your master, and by God, you're going to give it to him." When Bell protests further, Lewis Powell pushes past him, saying, "Out of my way, nigger. I'm going up." Bell simply doesn't know how to stop the intruder. Powell starts climbing the steps from the foyer to the living room. Bell is a step behind at all times, pleading forgiveness and politely asking that Powell tread more softly. The sound of the Southerner's heavy work boots on the wooden steps echoes through the house. "I'm sorry I talked rough to you," Bell says sheepishly. "That's all right," Powell sighs, pleased that the hardest part of the plot is behind him. He feared he wouldn't gain access to the Seward home and would botch his part of the plan. The next step is locating Seward's bedroom. Out front, in the shadow of the tree, across the street, David Harold holds their horses, prepared for the escape. But now the secretary's son, Frederick, stands at the top of the stairs in a dressing gown, blocking Powell's path. He was in bed with his wife, but the sound of Powell's boots woke him. Young Seward, fresh off a heady day that saw him represent his father at Lincoln's cabinet meeting, demands to know Powell's business. Politely and deferentially, Powell holds up the medicine vial and swears that Dr. Verdi told him to deliver it to William Seward and William Seward only. Seward takes one look at Powell and misjudges him as a simpleton. Rather than argue, he walks into his father's bedroom to see if he's awake. This is the break the assassin is looking for. Now he knows exactly which room belongs to the Secretary of State. He grows excited, eager to get the job done as quickly as possible. He can feel the revolver stuffed inside his waistband. Frederick Seward returns. He's sleeping. "Give it to me." "I was ordered to give it to the secretary." "You cannot see Mr. Seward. I am his son and the Assistant Secretary of State. Go back and tell the doctor that I refuse to let you go into the sick room because Mr. Seward was sleeping." "Very well, sir," says Powell, handing Frederick the vial. "I will go." As Frederick Seward accepts the vial, Powell turns and takes 3 steps down the stairs. Suddenly, he turns again. He sprints back up to the landing, drawing a Navy revolver. He levels the gun, curses, and pulls the trigger. But the gun jams. Frederick Seward will later tell police he thought he was a dead man. Frederick cries out in fear and pain, throwing up his arms to defend himself. He has the advantage of standing 1 step higher than Powell, but only for a second. The two men grapple as Powell leaps onto the landing and then uses the butt of his gun to pistol whip Frederick. Finally, Frederick Seward is knocked unconscious. His body makes a horrible thud as he collapses to the floor, his skull shattered in 2 places. Gray brain matter trickling out through the gashes, blood streaming down his face. "Murder, murder, murder," cries William Bell from the ground floor. He sprints out the front door and into the night, screaming at the top of his lungs. Across the street, David Harold holds the 2 getaway horses. Bell's cries are sure to bring soldiers and police to the house within minutes. Suddenly, the long list of reasons why Harold wants to be part of the Lincoln conspiracy are forgotten. He panics. He ties Powell's horse to a tree, spurs his own mount, and gallops down 15th Street. Back inside the Seward home, Lewis Powell isn't done. He pounds on Frederick's head without mercy, blood spattering the walls and his own hands and face. The beating is so savage that Powell's pistol literally falls to pieces in his hands. Only then does he stand up straight and begin walking toward the Secretary of State's bedroom. Chapter 41, Friday, April 14, 1865, Washington, 10:15 p.m. The commotion in the hallway and the sound of a body dropping heavily to the hardwood floor have alerted 20-year-old Fanny Seward to the intrusion. The daughter of the Secretary of State is clad only in a nightdress and has been sitting at the foot of her father's bed, trying to coax him to sleep. Also inside the room is Sergeant George Robinson, sent by the Army to watch over Seward. Now Private Robinson pushes his full weight against the door, even as the assassin tries to fight his way in. Soon Lewis Powell forces open the door and slashes at Robinson with his Bowie knife, cutting the soldier's forehead to the bone and almost putting out an eye. As Robinson crumbles to the ground, Fanny Seward places herself between Powell and her father. "Please don't kill him," she begs, terrified. "Please, please don't kill him." Secretary Seward then awakens on the bed. Something about the word kill jars him from his slumber. Powell punches Fanny Seward hard in the face, instantly knocking her unconscious. A split second later, he's on the bed, plunging his knife downward into Seward's neck and shoulders. The room is pitch black, save for the sliver of light from the open door. Powell's first thrust misses, making a hollow thud as it slams into the headboard. Seward desperately tries to roll away from his attacker and squeeze down into the gap between the mattress and the wall. He doesn't succeed. Powell kneels over him, stabbing Seward again and again and again. The secretary wears a splint on his broken jaw, which luckily deflects the knife away from the jugular vein, but it does little to protect the rest of his skull. The right side of his face is sliced away from the bone and now hangs like a flap. Blood jets from three deep punctures in his neck, drenching his now useless bandages, his nightdress, and the white bedsheets. Blood also splatters all over Powell's torso. The assassin is almost finished. Powell brings up the knife for one final killer blow. But at the exact moment, Seward's son Augustus enters the room. He is 39, a decorated graduate of West Point and a career Army officer. He has fought in the Mexican War, battled the Apache, and seen action in the Civil War. Never once has he been injured. But now that changes. Powell leaps at August Seward, stabbing him seven times. In the midst of the attack, Private Robinson staggers to his feet and rejoins the fight. For his trouble, Robinson is stabbed four more times. Powell is finally exhausted. Lying in front of him are four human beings, all of them still alive. But Powell doesn't know that. He steps over Fanny's limp body and races from the room, still clutching the knife. At that very moment, State Department messenger Emmerich Hansell arrives at the Seward home on official business. He sees Powell covered with blood, running down the steps and turns to flee for his life. But Powell catches him, stabbing the courier just above the fourth vertebrae. Powell is in such a hurry, fortunately, that he pulls his knife back out before it can go any deeper, thus sparing Hansell's life. I'm mad," Powell screams as he runs into the night, hoping to scare off anyone who might try to stop him. He is, however, anything but mad. Powell is as lucid as he is powerful. He now turns all his focus to the getaway. With adrenaline coursing through his veins, his senses heightened, and his broad shoulders aching from fists rained down upon him in the fight, he hurls the blood-covered knife into the gutter. He then looks right and left into the darkness for David Harold and their getaway horses. Seeing nothing, he listens for a telltale clip-clop of approaching horseshoes. "Murder, murder," William Bell cries from the porch, risking his life by chasing after Powell. Soldiers come running from a nearby sentry box. Powell sees his horse now tied to a tree where Harold left it. Realizing he has been betrayed, Powell feels his heart sink. He knows that without Harold, he will be lost on the streets of Washington. Still, he can't very well just stand around. He needs to get moving. Powell unties the horse and mounts up. He has the good sense to wipe the blood and sweat from his face with a handkerchief. Then, instead of galloping away, he kicks his heels gently into the horse's flanks and trots casually down 15th Street, trailed all the while by William Bell and his shouts of murder. But instead of stopping him, the unsuspecting soldiers ignore the black man and run right past Powell. After a block and a half, Bell falls behind. He eventually returns to the Seward home, where four gravely injured men and one woman lie. Incredibly, they will all recover, but this horrific night will haunt them for the rest of their lives. Lewis Powell trots his horse toward the darkness on the edge of town. There he hides in a field and wonders if he will ever find a way out of Washington. Powell's thoughts then turn to President Lincoln and Vice President Johnson. They should be dead by now. Chapter 42, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 10:15 p.m. As John Wilkes Booth tiptoes into the state box and Lewis Powell knocks on William Seward's front door, George Azarode, the would-be assassin of Vice President Andrew Johnson, is drinking hard, late for his date with destiny. If any man in Washington has incurred the wrath of the Confederacy, it is Johnson, the former governor of Tennessee, whom many Southerners consider a rank traitor. Johnson's bitter words are seldom compatible with Lincoln's. So it is no surprise that his views on punishing the South stand in stark contrast to Lincoln's lenience. And what shall be done with the leaders of the rebel host? I know what I would do if I were president. I would arrest them as traitors, I would try them as traitors, and by the eternal, I would hang them as traitors. Johnson shouted from the steps of the War Department as recently as Monday night. Like Johnson, Azarode, the carriage painter, is staying at the Kirkwood House on the corner of Pennsylvania Avenue and 12th Street, four blocks from the White House and just one block from Ford's Theater. He has passed the time aimlessly since his meeting with Booth and the other conspirators, drawing attention to himself through the simple act of trying not to draw attention to himself. At 9:30, he visits Naylor's stable on E Street to pick up his horse. The owner knows George Azarode and his friend David Harold, and does not care for either of them. Nevertheless, when a nervous, sweating Azarode asks if he could get a drink, Naylor answers with a quick, "Don't mind if I do." He's concerned about Harold, who rented a horse from him earlier that day and is long overdue. Naylor hopes that Azarode will disclose his friend's location after a drink or two. They leave Azarode's mare and walk to the bar of the Union Hotel. Azarode, whom Naylor suspects has been drinking for some time, orders a stiff whiskey. Naylor chugs a tankard of ale. Azarode pays. They return to the stable after just one round, with Naylor none the wiser about Harold's location. "Your friend is staying out very late with his horse," Naylor finally prods. Azarode has just handed him a $5 tip for boarding his horse. "He'll be back after a while," Azarode glibly replies as he mounts the mare. But Azarode is too wasted on alcohol to ride a straight line. He almost falls out of the saddle when the mare takes a sudden turn. On a hunch, Naylor decides to follow Azarode on foot. The trail, however, is only a block long. Azarode dismounts and ties the horse at a hitching post in front of the Kirkwood House. Naylor waits across the street just out of sight. When Azarode walks back out a few minutes later and trots the mare over to Ford's Theater, Naylor gives up the surveillance and returns to his stable. Andrew Johnson, meanwhile, is behaving very much like a man waiting to be summoned. He eats an early dinner alone. He turns down a last-minute invitation to attend our American cousin. His assistant is out for the night, and Johnson has no one to talk with. So he goes up to his room and lies down on his bed fully clothed, as if some great incident is about to occur, and he needs to be ready to spring into action on a moment's notice. Johnson is a boorish man. Largely uneducated, he learned to read and write late in his life. A tailor by trade, he entered politics in his 20s and worked his way up to the Senate. He owes a lot to President Lincoln, who first appointed him the military governor of Tennessee and then chose him to run on the vice presidential ticket after Lincoln asked Hannibal Hamlin of Maine to step down. Hamlin was a hardcore northerner, and Lincoln needed a southern presence on the ticket. Up until this point, Johnson has had no power at all. He is simply a figurehead. At 10:15, George Azarode is back inside the Kirkwood House, getting thoroughly smashed in the bar. Truth be told, even more than when he tried to bow out a few days earlier, the German-born carriage painter wants no part of murder. A few floors above him, Johnson lies alone in his room. In his lifetime, he will suffer the ignominy of impeachment and endure the moniker of worst president in history. Andrew Johnson will not, however, suffer the far worse fate of death at the hand of an assassin. For that, Johnson can thank the effects of alcohol, as a now very drunk George Azarode, continues to raise his glass. Chapter 43, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 10:15 p.m. John Wilkes Booth takes a bold step out of the shadows. Derringer clutched in his right fist and knife in his left. He extends his arm and aims for the back of Abraham Lincoln's head. No one sees him. No one knows he is there. Booth squeezes the trigger. Unlike the crazed Richard Lawrence, whose pistols misfired when he attempted to assassinate Andrew Jackson, Booth feels his gun kick. The ball launches down the barrel as the audience guffaws at the play. Abraham Lincoln has chosen this precise moment to lean forward and turn his head to the left for another long look down into the audience. A half second later, he would have been leaning so far forward that the ball would have missed his skull completely. But the president is not so lucky. The man who has worried and fretted and bullied America back from the brink of disaster, holding fast to his faith in the Union at a time when lesser men argued that it should be dissolved, feels a split-second snap of pain. And then, nothing at all. The ball entered through the occipital bone, about 1 inch to the left of the median line, and just above the left lateral sinus, which it opened, the autopsy will read. It then penetrated the dura mater, passed through the left posterior lobe of the cerebrum, entered the left lateral ventricle, and lodged in the white matter of the cerebrum just above the anterior portion of the left corpus striatum. The president's calvarium, or skull cap, will be removed with a saw. A surgeon will probe the exposed brain before slicing into it with a scalpel, using the path of coagulated blood to trace the trajectory of the ball. This will show that the ball entered behind the left ear and traveled diagonally across the brain, coming to rest above the right eye. Yet the autopsy will be inconclusive. Four different doctors will examine the body. Each will have a different conclusion about what happened once the sphere of Britannium metal poked a neat round hole in Lincoln's skull and then pushed fragments of that bone deep into Lincoln's brain as it traveled precisely 7.5 inches before plowing to a stop in the dense gray matter. At 10:15, on the night of April 14th, 1865, President Abraham Lincoln slumps forward in his rocking chair. Mary Lincoln, lost in the play until this very instant, stops laughing. Major Henry Reed Rathbone snaps his head around at the sound of gunfire, a sound he knows all too well from the battlefield. He's had his back to the door, but in an instant, he's on his feet, striking a defensive pose. John Wilkes Booth drops the derringer and switches the knife to his right hand, just in time, for Major Rathbone sets aside his own safety and vaults across a small space. Booth raises the knife to shoulder level and brings it down in a hacking motion. Rathbone throws his left arm up in a defensive reflex and instantly feels the knife cut straight down through the skin and biceps to the bone. Booth moves quickly. He steps to the front of the box, ignoring a stricken Mary Lincoln. "Freedom!" he bellows down to the audience, though in all the laughter and the growing confusion as to why the cast has added the sound of gunfire to the scene, his words are barely heard. Harry Hawk stands alone on the stage, staring up to the state box with growing concern. Booth hurls his body over the railing. Up until this point, he has performed every single aspect of the assassination perfectly. But now he misjudges the thickness of the massive United States flag decorating the front of the box. He means to hold on to the railing with one hand as he vaults, throwing his feet up and over the ledge, then landing on the stage like a conquering hero. This sort of leap is actually his specialty. Booth is famous among the theatrical community for his unrehearsed gymnastics, sometimes inserting jumps and drops into Shakespearean plays on a whim. During one memorable performance of Macbeth, his fall to the stage was several feet longer than the fall from the state box. But Booth's right spur gets tangled in the flag's folds. Instead of a gallant two-footed landing on the stage, Booth topples heavily from the state box. He drops to the boards awkwardly, left foot and two hands braced in a bumbling attempt to catch his fall. The fibula of Booth's lower left leg, a small bone that bears little weight, snaps 2 inches above the ankle. The fracture is complete, dividing the bone into two neat pieces. If not for the tightness of Booth's boot, which forms an immediate splint, the bone would poke through the skin. Now Booth lies on the stage in front of a nearly packed house. His leg is broken. He holds a blood-smeared dagger in his right hand. The sound of gunfire has just ricocheted around Ford's. Major Rathbone is bleeding profusely from a severe stab wound. And just above him, slumped forward, as if very drunk or very asleep, the President of the United States is unconscious. Yet still, nobody knows what happened. James Ford steps out of the box office and thinks Booth is pulling some crazy stunt to get attention. Observers in the audience have heard the pop and are amazed by the sudden appearance of a famous matinee idol making a cameo on the stage right before their very eyes, perhaps adding some comical whimsy to this very special evening. Harry Hawk still holds center stage, his head turned toward Booth, wondering why in the world he would intrude on the performance. Time stops for a second, but only one. Then the assassin takes charge. Booth dragged himself up on one knee, Hawk will later remember, and was slashing that long knife around him like one who was crazy. It was then, I am sure, I heard him say, "The South shall be free." I recognized Booth as he regained his feet and came toward me, waving his knife. I did not know what he had done or what his purpose might be. I did simply what any man would have done. I ran. Booth scurries to his feet and limps off the stage, with emotion, observes one spectator, like the hopping of a bullfrog. "Stop that man," Major Rathbone screams from above. "Won't somebody please stop that man?" Clara Harris echoes. "What is the matter?" cries a voice from the audience. "The president has been shot," she shouts back. The reverie is shattered, and with it all the joy of Washington's post-war celebration. The theater explodes in confusion. In an instant, the audience is on its feet. It is a scene of utter chaos, a hell of all hells. Men climb up and over seats, some fleeing toward the exits, while others race to the stage, hoping to climb up into the box and be part of the action. Women faint. Children are trapped in the panic. "Water," some yell, tending to the collapsed. A former congressman yells something far more pointed. "Hang the scoundrel." Meantime, Booth passes within inches of leading lady Laura Keene as he limps off the stage. William Withers, the orchestra leader with whom he had a drink just hours earlier, stands between Booth and his stage door. Withers is paralyzed with fear, but Booth assumes he is intentionally blocking the way and slashes at him, the sharp blade ripping through the collar of my coat, penetrating my vest and undergarments, and inflicting a flesh wound in my neck, Withers will later testify. Only one man is bold enough to give chase. Set carpenter Jake Ritherspaw and Booth reach the stage door at the very same time. Booth thrusts the knife blade at him. Ritherspaw leaps back, and in that instant, Booth is gone, squeezing through the door and hauling himself up into the saddle. Rather than give Peanut John the shiny nickel the boy had hoped for, Booth kicks him hard and bludgeons him with the butt of his knife. "He kicked me," the boy moans, falling to the ground. At the same instant, yet another spontaneous torchlight parade blocks Booth's getaway on 10th Street. He swerves into the alley, spurs his horse down the cobblestones dividing two large brick buildings, and then turns onto F Street, completely avoiding the procession. In an instant, John Wilkes Booth disappears into the night. Chapter 44, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 10:20 p.m. John Wilkes Booth slows the mayor to a walk. Word is already spreading through Washington that the president has been shot. The news is shouted, breathlessly exclaimed, passed from citizen to citizen, bonfire to bonfire. People aren't racing away from Ford's, they're racing to Ford's to see for themselves if these wild rumors are true. Victory marches turn into mobs of the curious and scared, determined to fight their way to the theater. When a drunk shouts into the night, "I'm glad it happened," a furious mob beats him and kicks him unconscious, tearing off his clothes, and they haul his limp body to a lamppost for a lynching. Ironically, he will be rescued by the Union cavalry. Now another troop of cavalry is summoned to Ford's and plunges recklessly through the throngs assembled outside. Inside, the crowd surges toward the stage, trapping small children in its midst, chanting all the while that Booth must be lynched. Laura Keene has the presence of mind to march to center stage and cry for calm and sanity, but her words go unheeded. The crush against the stage is made worse as the news explodes into the street in front of Ford's Theater. Passersby rush inside to see for themselves, some of them hoping that Booth is still trapped inside, but most just wanting a glimpse of the injured president. Across town at Grover's Theater, the patriotic celebration is in full swing. A young boy is reciting a poem when a man bursts into the theater and shouts that the president has been shot. As the crowd reacts in horror, a young soldier stands and yells for everyone to sit still. "It's a ruse of the pickpockets," he says, explaining that thieves spread such disinformation to fleece the crowd as people rush to the exit. The 600 theatergoers take their seats once again. The boy on stage exits, his poetry reading complete. But he is back just seconds later, struggling to control his voice as he shares the horrific news that President Lincoln has indeed been shot. Tad Lincoln, the president's 12-year-old son, is in the audience with a White House staffer. Stunned, he returns to the White House immediately, where he collapses into the arms of the doorkeeper, shouting, "They've killed Papa dead. They've killed Papa dead." Soon more bad news begins to spread. Secretary Seward has been assaulted in his bed. At Woolman's Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue, the bartender shouts out the mournful news that Lincoln has been shot. Michael Laughlin, the would-be conspirator who stalked the Grants last night, drinks in the corner. He is drunk again, but still coherent enough to know that in an instant, Booth is the killer, and that he must get out of town before someone implicates him. In front of the Willard Hotel, the stable foreman John Fletcher is still seething that David Harold hasn't returned the roan he rented earlier. At that very moment, Harold trots past. "You get off that horse now," Fletcher cries, springing onto the street and grabbing for the bridle. But Harold spurs the horse and gallops away. Acting quickly, Fletcher sprints back to his stable, saddles a horse, and races after him. In the middle of all this, a lone rider galloping away from the chaos at Ford's would most certainly attract attention. So Booth guides the mare slowly up and down the streets and alleys of Washington, even as his veins course with adrenaline and euphoria, and pandemonium breaks out all around him. Despite his considerable celebrity, Booth blends in and proceeds unmolested through the streets. It is Friday night. After all, a time when Washington comes to life. There are plenty of men trotting horses through town. It's only when Booth finally nears the end of the 3-mile journey to the Navy Yard Bridge that his fears about being caught force him to spur the horse and ride hard to freedom. It is 10:45 when Booth pulls back on the reins once again and canters up to the wooden drawbridge by the Navy Yard, almost 30 long minutes since the Derringer did its deadly job. Booth approaches like a man confident that his path will go unblocked. "Where are you going, sir?" cries the military sentry. His name is Silas T. Cobb, and his long and boring shift will be over at midnight. He notices the lather on the horse's flanks, a sign that it's been ridden hard. "Home, down in Charles," Booth replies. "Didn't you know, my friend, that it is against the law to pass here after 9 o'clock? Cobb is required to challenge anyone entering or exiting Washington. But the truth of the matter is, the war has ended, and with it the formal restrictions on crossing the bridge after curfew. He wants no trouble, just to finish his shift in peace and get a good night's sleep." "No," lies Booth. He explains that he's been waiting for the full moon to rise so that he might navigate the darkened roads by night. And indeed, a waning moon is rising at that very moment. "I will pass you," Cobb says, "but I don't know that I ought to." "Hell, I guess there'll be no trouble about that," Booth shoots back, ignoring the rule that horses be walked across a bridge. He trots the mare into the night. Booth is barely across the Potomac when David Harold approaches Silas T. Cobb. He gives his name just as Smith. Once again, after a brief discussion, Cobb lets him pass. One more rider approaches Cobb that night. He is John Fletcher, the stable foreman who was following David Harold. Fletcher can clearly see Harold on the other side of the bridge, now disappearing into the Maryland night. "You can cross," Cobb tells him, "but my orders say I can't let anyone back across the bridge until morning." The Maryland countryside, with its smugglers and spies and illicit operatives, is the last place John Fletcher wants to spend the night. He turns his horse reins back toward his stable, settling on the hope that Harold and the missing horse will one day make the mistake of riding back into Washington. In fact, Fletcher will never see the horse again, for it will soon be shot dead, its body left to rot in the backwoods of Maryland, yet another victim of the most spectacular assassination conspiracy in the history of man. Chapter 45, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 10:20 p.m. Lincoln's life is slipping away. Mary Lincoln lays her head to the president's breast as Major Rathbone uses his one good arm to yank the music stand from its notch in the doorway. Booth's knife missed a major artery by just 1/3 of an inch. Otherwise, Rathbone would now be dead. The major swings open the outer door of the state box. Dozens of unruly theatergoers fill a dress circle and try to fight their way into the state box. "Doctors only," Rathbone shouts as blood drips from his arm and pools on the floor. The truth is that the major needs medical attention, but all eyes are on Lincoln. "I'm bleeding to death," Rathbone shouts as a 23-year-old doctor, Charles Leal, fights his way forward. Dr. Leal came to the theater solely because he wanted to see Lincoln in person. Now he is the first physician to come upon the crime scene. Leal reaches out a hand and lifts Rathbone's chin so that he might look into his eyes and gauge his physical condition. Noting in an instant that Rathbone is quite obviously not bleeding to death, Dr. Leal turns his attention to Lincoln. "Oh, doctor," sobs Mary Lincoln as Leal slowly removes her from her husband's body. "Can he recover? Will you take charge of him?" "I will do what I can," Dr. Leal says calmly. With a nod to the crowd of men who have followed him into the box, the young doctor makes it clear that Mary must be removed. She is ushered to a couch on the other side of the box next to Clara Harris, who begins stroking her hand. Leal asks for a lamp and orders that no one else be admitted to the state box except for physicians. Then he stands in front of the rocking chair facing Lincoln's slumped head. He pushes the body upright, the head lolling back against the rocker. He can feel the slightest breath from Lincoln's nose and mouth, but Leal is reluctant to touch the body without making a preliminary observation. One thing, however, is quite clear. Lincoln is not dead. Dr. Leal can't find any sign of injury. Onlookers light matches so that he can see better, and the call goes out for a lamp. The front of Lincoln's body shows no sign of physical violence, and the forward slumping indicates that the attack must have come from behind. Yet there's no visible entry wound or exit wound. If Dr. Leal didn't know better, he would swear that Lincoln simply dozed off and will awaken any minute. "Put him on the floor," the doctor orders, gently, ever so gently. Lincoln's long torso is lifted by men standing on both sides of the rocking chair and then lowered to the carpet. Based on Major Rathbone's wounds and the fact that he didn't hear any gunshot during the performance, Leal deduces that Lincoln was stabbed. He rolls the president on one side and carefully searches for a puncture wound, his fingers slipping along the skin, probing for a telltale oozing of blood. But he feels nothing, and when he pulls his hands away, they're completely clean. He strips Lincoln to the waist and continues to search, cutting off the president's white shirt with a pocket knife. But his skin is milky white and smooth with no sign of any harm. Leal lifts Lincoln's eyelids and examines the pupils. Finding clear evidence that the right eye's optic nerve has somehow been cut, he decides to re-examine. Perhaps Lincoln was stabbed in the back of the skull. Head wounds are notorious bleeders, so such a wound is unlikely, but there has to be some explanation. Dr. Leal, more befuddled by the mystery with each passing moment, runs his hands through Lincoln's hair. This time, they come back blood red. Alarmed, Leal examines the president's head a second time. Beneath the thick hair, just above and behind the left ear, hides a small blood clot. It's no bigger than the doctor's pinky, but when he pulls his finger away, the sensation is like a cork being removed from a bottle.